Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again. I am Carolyn Yeager, and tonight my guest is Friedrich Paul Berg, whose very informative website is www.nazigassings.com. That's Gassings, plural, with an S. Friedrich Berg has been a revisionist for a long time and has expertise in several areas, and I think most of you are familiar with him, so I'm just going to say, hi, Friedrich, how are you?
Hello, Carolyn. Nice to hear you.
I'm fine. Good. Well, I'm glad to have you here, and I want to do my Elie Wiesel watch and get your comments on it. I do this now before the beginning of every show, and once again today, I want to repeat about the Elie Wiesel Salman Rushdie dinner and moderated forum that's to benefit the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and that has been sold out, according to them, and is occurring on May 31st in Montreal, Canada. Now, that's next Monday night, so this is my last opportunity to talk about this great opportunity for any Canadians to go and assemble there and do some demonstrating against Elie Wiesel. And what we have going on now is something new, the Elie Wiesel Tattoo Contest, which is a good vehicle to use for demonstrating, because you can say that a reward is being offered for anyone who can provide an authentic picture of Elie's Auschwitz number tattooed on his very own arm. This is not Holocaust denial. You could even see it as upholding the Holocaust by exposing imposters. And, of course, not too many people would see it that way, but I really wish more people would respond to this Elie Wiesel business than I have been noticing have been doing so. So I'd like to know what your opinion on all this is. How do you see this?
Well, I think Elie Wiesel's story, at least the story we're given, is very strange and problematic from the exterminationist point of view for all kinds of reasons. I'm quite sure he doesn't have a tattoo on his arm. I've looked at those pictures, and I haven't seen any trace of a tattoo there, although maybe there is. I just don't know. Many parts of his story really don't make sense. He claims that he was assigned to Monowitz, which was the petrochemical plant for making synthetic fuels, while he was at Auschwitz. And that doesn't make any sense to me, because at that time he was like 17, 18 years old. He didn't have any particular skills that would have been useful, like welding or pipe fitting or anything like that. It's heavy work in a petrochemical plant, and he was physically a runt from everything I've ever seen of him. And he doesn't strike me as the kind of person the Germans would have even wanted to have near to a petrochemical plant. So that part of his story just does not make any sense to me. I think it's bogus. Let me say something else about the Elie Wiesel story that I think is very important. In his book, Night, which almost everyone has had in their hands, it would seem, whether they actually read it is very doubtful, but he does talk about the fact that he and his father chose, on their own, to go with the retreating Nazis in January of 1945. And this strikes me as a very revealing part of the survivor story, and it thoroughly undermines the idea that Auschwitz was any kind of an extermination camp.
Well, I agree with you about all of that, Friedrich, but, you know, I think that this is a part of the problem that we're having here, if I might say. I think that people are so attached to their disagreements with Ellie and his foolish story that they don't want to give up his story, because if he's an imposter and wasn't there, his story about it doesn't mean anything.
That's a good
even
point.
Even though it's typical. In my opinion, if you want to think about percentages, it's like 90% sure that Ellie Wiesel is a complete imposter because of the documents that show that there's no record of him being there, and that the number that he says he has, who he was, belongs to someone else, and his father's too. So while there may be some loose ends, there are, and it's not like, you know, open and shut, absolute 100% proof, but it's like, to me, like 90%, that's good enough. And yet people still want to think in terms to talk about Ellie Wiesel and criticize him in the usual ways.
Well, I see your point, and I accept that as a valid point, except that the records are not complete. We don't, as far as I know, have any records of him having been at Auschwitz at any time from the from the archives in Auschwitz. So my feeling, and I'll just give this as an idea, is that he was at Auschwitz for a while and went through a quarantine and a delousing procedure and a cleanup and was then assigned somewhere else, as was the case with many, many Jews and Eastern Europeans who went to Auschwitz. Auschwitz served as a kind of Ellis Island for processing and checking out and cleaning up people who were destined to go to work somewhere in Germany. And I suspect he was assigned somewhere, and then he somehow managed to appear in Buchenwald at the very end of the war. And even that is, of course, questionable, but there is some reason to believe that he might have appeared at Buchenwald and then from there went on to Paris and have a good time there and so forth. So there are many big holes in the story we're given, and I'm not going to try to plug them up here, but I've just...
Well, I can't really agree with that. My feeling is that my strong sense is that he was never at Auschwitz, and he was never at Buchenwald, and he was never at any of these places, and that he has created this story with help from some people and information that he got, because he has no record of Buchenwald either. He really doesn't. There's some records there, but they're not him. They're not his birth date. They're not anything like that. And then his story about all these places is so wrong. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So I agree with you that Jews went there and were then transferred somewhere else. That if he went through that, he would have a better grasp of what happened. But what he writes and what he says is completely out of whack with what actually occurred there.
It's not out of whack with what other Jews have believed and were quite happy to see him put in writing. Okay, so it's not as if his story is concocted out of whole cloth. He has told people, Jews, a story that most of them have embraced. So there is some...
Yeah, they've embraced it.
Credibility there. Okay, I don't know what the exact facts are, but it's obvious that when he claimed he and his father chose to go west with the Nazis in January of 1945, that did not cause some kind of uproar in the Jewish community. They pretty much accepted that as, you know, an odd but interesting story of this one particular person.
Fritz, what uproar has been caused by what any of these...
Well, you saw an
uproar. Survivors say
we've had this incident just recently where an Auschwitz survivor who claimed that he was drafted into the German military has now been sort of banned from public appearances. Now that's a story that's been in the news the last few weeks. Now that is a rather interesting story. That's a small story, but Elie Wiesel got a Nobel Peace Prize.
That's right. That's the difference. That's a small story. This is a small guy. It, you know, but nobody's going to question what Elie Wiesel says. They're not going to question it, no matter what it is.
Elie Wiesel was not the great public figure that he is today 30 years ago. Hardly anybody knew about this guy 30 years ago.
Well, they weren't questioning anything 30 years ago either, but now they're starting to question some of these people because there's so many of them out there giving speeches and talks, and they're lying, and so they realize it's starting to make them look, it's making the whole, all the survivors look questionable, so they have their... They're being a little tougher on that. But this is just a situation where this man's family came forth and said, you know, he's really not, this stuff that he's saying is really isn't true. And so then they thought, well, they better not have him in there. It's not as, to me, it's not really indicative of what's going on today. But we focus on it because it's one of the few. Well, let's move on anyway, because I know we've got a lot of great stuff to talk about. So I want to mention that Seymour here is talking about latest news. Just came out with some accusations that prisoners were being executed, battlefield executions in Afghanistan. And he says that, and he has a lot of credibility with everyone, and he says that what's happening is that they've been told in Afghanistan that if they can't get good intelligence out of their prisoners, the Taliban prisoners, within a short period of time, they have to let them go. And he's saying that, well, what he's finding out from reports from many people that are involved there is that they're not letting them go. They're turning them over to the Afghan troops, and as soon as they walk away, these guys are being assassinated. So that's interesting, speaking about how our American troops and our allied troops are behaving even today in wartime. And I think you told me that you had seen something similar to that on TV yesterday.
Well, on TV, on PBS, there was a program called Frontline talking about American veterans from Iraq stationed at, I think it's Fort Carson near Colorado Springs, who have a great many psychological problems arising from the war. And some of these problems are resolved by these young men resorting to drugs and alcohol and even violence. And it's a very serious problem. It arises to a great extent from the fact that they were committing atrocities in Iraq, killing civilians without any justification whatsoever, and getting away with it, and being even encouraged to do that, possibly during this surge period. And it's very shocking, but it was a very good program because you actually heard the voices and the interviews of the American soldiers who were involved in these atrocities. And now we see the problems that they're dealing with and that our society is facing in dealing with them. So that was a very good program, and I urge everyone to see it again if they can.
Yes, well, my opinion on this is that these atrocities happen because these soldiers are encouraged to hate the enemy. They're given a lot of atrocity type encouragement beforehand, and then they look upon the enemy as something subhuman, and they just don't have any moral codes. I just don't think our military, I think it's lost all of its moral code in this, because they're losing all the time, and so this American bravado is having a hard time in justifying itself.
Well, I'm not sure they ever were any better. In World War II, they were worse. And the problem during World War II is that they were often encouraged by their commanding officers very openly. And on my website, www.nazigassings.com, which I urge everyone to look at, I have a short story about General George S. Patton and how he encouraged American soldiers to kill prisoners and eventually rape women in Germany. And it's no secret now, thanks to the writing of a an historian, a biographer for George Patton. The name of the author is Daniel P. Hurston. And in 2002, he published the book General Patton, A Soldier's Life, which is perhaps, and quite probably, the best book on Patton ever written. And it is, I think, rather meaningful that the book only appeared in 2002, more than 50 years after Patton's death. I suspect the reason it has only appeared now is because the author couldn't get it published earlier, because Patton was held up as the great military genius, the answer to Erwin Rommel and some of the other German generals, when in fact Patton was guilty of mass murder himself. He was apparently very much involved with five massacres of prisoners in Sicily, and these are spelled out in the book. There was some investigating by officers in the American Army at the time in Sicily, but Patton was essentially given a pass and protected, and yet he openly called for the killing of prisoners and the raping of German women. Well, let me read the actual words that he apparently used on June 27th, 1943, according to Captain Howard Cry. He said to kill and to continue to kill, and that the more we killed, then the less we'd have to kill later, and the better the division would be in the long run. Now, there was a lot of warrior talk during wartime by all sides. It happens, and a good officer tries to get his men to be great warriors and killers of the enemy and so forth. But the killing of prisoners, or the calling for the killing of prisoners, is really inexcusable, very shameful, cowardly, despicable, and criminal. If the Germans had done that, if Erwin Rommel had encouraged German soldiers to murder prisoners, he would certainly be condemned, and rightly so, as a monster. Officers have a tough time controlling their men. Their men are young, they're eager, they're frightened, and they're armed with extremely powerful, deadly weapons. It's very hard to control young men in that kind of a situation. But if officers actually encourage their men to commit crimes and condone crimes, that is inexcusable. I think the problem with the American military is that there really is a terrible lack of discipline, and this has been a problem from the earliest days of our great democracy, for want of a better word. Patton also called for raping women and pillaging the towns in Germany. And it showed itself.
Run the sons of bitches into the sea.
Run the sons of bitches into the sea. That was another quote from Patton. But he had a capacity for being vulgar and vile in his public statements that was unmatched by anyone else. You asked earlier about General Bradley. Bradley, at the time of the Normandy invasion, he actually said that he didn't want to be bothered with stories about German snipers being executed out of hand after they were captured. So there was an atmosphere towards German prisoners, and especially members of the SS, that was absolutely inexcusable. Patton's brother-in-law claimed after the war, after interviewing another officer, that the Americans shot four or five prisoners for every prisoner killed by a German. Is that necessarily accurate? I don't know. But I do know from my own anecdotal contacts with GIs that the Americans killed lots and lots and lots of prisoners, and they got away with it because nobody was going to make a fuss. I was shocked many years ago by a friend, Thomas Pakenham, who had been in the American Army and fought at Monte Cassino for many, many months. And he told me stories about how American soldiers, just for the hell of it, would take pot shots at Italian women in the countryside, just to see if they could hit them and kill them and so forth. And they did this gratuitously, without
how
any...
How did they do that with people that were like Italian women and so on?
Well, I mean, because they're crazy to begin with. These guys are half crazy by the time they're through basic training, and they're anxious, they're frustrated young kids. They're out to prove that they really are tough, that they're men, that they can kill. And what's easier than killing some Italian woman in the distance who they feel like shooting for one reason or other? The same thing was occurring in Germany after the war. The name of the American soldier who was there, who saw this, escapes me. I apologize for that, but he's done a bit of writing on the subject. He was at one of the prisoner of war camps where German prisoners were treated atrociously in these open fields, and he remembered going into the German villages with American soldiers and seeing Americans just take pot shots with their pistols at people in their windows of their houses and just, you know, shoot at the civilians for the hell of it. Why not? You know, they were all evil monsters, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
They were all responsible for the Holocaust. So they were Huns and monsters,
yeah,
and so forth. What's wrong with killing them? And this was very, very common. Rape was also very common, although it might not have been as bad as what the Russians did. I suspect it wasn't as bad as what the Russians did. But the rape by American soldiers was also extremely common, and very few were ever prosecuted for such atrocities and crimes.
Absolutely.
Some were. In northern France, I think there were 70 cases of rape which were prosecuted, and a number of them were hung.
And what would happen to these men who raped?
Well, some were hung, and it turned out, unfortunately, that most of these guys who were hung were black. The whites who were convicted of rape were not generally hung at all. But if they were black, they were hung.
Well, see, they saw that as worse. Really. They did.
Yeah.
And probably we all kind of do, but in the same thing. Well, anyway, Patton, if Patton says to them, the more we kill now, the less we have to kill later, or so on, or the more, you know, the better off it is. So naturally, they get this idea. Like you say, these aren't the most intelligent people in the world, a lot of these soldiers, and they're not experienced, and they, you know, if you give them an idea like that, just like when we talk about the Russians in Ehrenberg or what,
Ehrenberg.
Say kill, you know, then by God, that's what they're going to do. I just finished a very interesting book by a German officer. He was not SS, he was regular Wehrmacht. But some of the comments, and he was not attacking the enemies, and he was talking about, you know, the war, more of the tactical things and what they did and what, you know, what was happening in his units and divisions and so on. But he made the comment that after the war in the camp that he was in, and everybody noticed that the Americans were very arrogant. You know, they had a very arrogant attitude. But where he was, they weren't committing the terrible things that they did in some. Now, what about Eisenhower? Eisenhower was the same in his nasty statements and his encouragement.
Well, I don't think he was as bad as Patton. He had a deep hatred that he made no secret about for Germans, and he didn't even allow American officers to return a salute from a German officer. Opposed to any kind of fraternization between German civilians, including even German women, and American soldiers, because they wanted to keep the Germans down as much as possible, and paved the way, no doubt, for the Morgenthau Plan and the atrocious crimes that America had in stock for Germany, which included the looting of Germany from end to end, which actually occurred. And which I do talk about. So there was a widespread racist hatred against the Germans in general, and this showed itself in little ways and in big ways.
Yes, the French were also very,
yes,
very nasty whenever they got the chance.
Well, the Free French, the French troops who were fighting with the Americans on the same side and so forth, most French people really were very indifferent.
Oh, the people were okay, yeah. Because they weren't treated badly, but the soldiers, particularly the resistance, or had any connection with the resistance.
Right, the Maquis. The Maquis.
Well, we have to break for now, Fritz, and we've come up to our midpoint, and we have to break for our news break. So, we'll, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, the first official evidence of Israel possessing nuclear weapons may have been discovered by a U.S. academic. Britain's Guardian newspaper has published the declassified agreement, which suggests Israel offered to sell arms to South Africa in the 1970s. RT's Paula Sleer has more.
It's always been well known that Israel had a relationship with apartheid South Africa, but the extent, the scope, the nature of that relationship has always been shrouded in mystery. What we're hearing now from the British newspaper The Guardian is that back in the 1970s, there was a series of high-level secret meetings between the then Israeli Defense Minister Shimon Peres, who is today Israel's president, and the then South African Defense Minister P.W. Botha. And according to the minutes of these meetings, South Africa asked Israel for nuclear warheads, and Israel responded by offering three different kinds. Now, these documents have come to light by an American author who was researching a book on the close relationship between Israel and apartheid South Africa. And according to that author, the current Israeli authorities put a lot of pressure on the post-apartheid South African government not to declassify these documents. As you can well imagine, the reaction from Israeli authorities has been one of denial. We've heard from a spokesperson from President Shimon Peres' residence, and he said, and I'm quoting, "We regret that the newspaper did not find it right to ask for an official response and examine the facts with official Israeli sources." Other Israeli sources have called this a complete fabrication, completely denying this report. Having said that, though, if this report does prove to be true, it will be the first official evidence that there has been that Israel has nuclear weapons. As you well know, Israel's policy until now has been one of neither denying nor confirming that it has a nuclear arsenal. They have constantly followed a policy of ambiguity. If this also proves true, Israel will find it hard-pressed to prove its argument that even if it has nuclear weapons, it is a responsible country, as opposed to Iran and the whole question around a possible nuclear ban. Israel has constantly maintained that Iran is a threat and cannot be trusted by the international community. What is also interesting is that all of this is coming to light in line with Mordechai Vanunu, who is the nuclear whistleblower here in Israel, being sent back to prison for 3 months. Vanunu was arrested back in December when he violated the terms of his parole by meeting with a foreigner. Vanunu was arrested back in 1986 and spent 18 years in prison for revealing the inner workings of Israel's nuclear plant in Dimona to the British Sunday Times newspaper. Vanunu was offered a 3-month jail sentence or a 3-month community service, and he's been sent to prison because he insisted on serving that community service in Arab East Jerusalem, and the Israeli authorities saying that that could not be accepted. There's certainly a lot of questions being asked in Israel today. If these documents prove true, it sheds light on what is going on behind the scenes and the whole question of whether or not Israel really does have nuclear weapons.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I'm here with Friedrich Paul Berg, and we have been talking about Allied war crimes during World War II. I've got a list here, which I'm not going to go through, but it was compiled by Professor Franz Seidler and Alfred de Zayas in one of their books, and it's all documented incidents in 1944 and 1945 of American military personnel who killed, captured, mostly captured, I mean, these were captured SS and captured Wehrmacht soldiers who were killed by every kind of method, machine gunning, shots through the neck, through the back of the head. Mostly that was the way they did it. They're prisoners rather than keeping them as prisoners. And it goes on and on and on. And some were large numbers, like 100 or 200 and some at a time. Some were small numbers. But I'm not going to go through that, but I want you to be aware of that, that this kind of behavior was going on by Americans. And, of course, I don't know how much of it was going on by the British soldiers, but I know that the French were doing it whenever they could. And much worse than all these reports that we get about how the Germans were somehow executing their prisoners. But this is nothing compared to the bombing atrocities. Isn't that right, Fritz?
Yes, it is. And it was the British who started the deliberate bombing of civilians and civilian targets. It was not the Germans at all. And America had more than enough good reason to know that very well. The first British bombing of a civilian target occurred on May 11th of 1940. And the bombing attacks on civilian targets, purely civilian targets, continued throughout the war. But there were already nearly 40 attacks, bombing attacks on German targets before the Germans responded with the first attack on any British civilian target on September 7th of 1940, nearly 4 months after the first British attack. And the British were very open about these attacks on German targets. Churchill actually bragged about the fact that every night, or almost every night, British planes were going over German cities and bombing them, and he was very proud of that. The bombing of Berlin began in August of 1940. There were 5 attacks on Berlin. Each attack had about 80 bombers in it before Hitler decided this was enough, this was too much, and responded with the first German attack on London on September 7th. Now, Hitler was always urging the British to stop. He was giving the British peace offers. The British could have made peace throughout this period and over the entire war up to that point without losing any British territory. It was not that the British Isles were in any danger whatsoever. They weren't. It was Germany that made peace offer after peace offer to the British to try to end this silly war that was going on and on and doing no good for anyone. The British lost their entire empire as a result of Churchill's madness. Germany lost the war, but at least Germany remained a relatively free country. It was not totally enslaved by communism. But it was the Germans who tried to make peace. It was Hitler who tried to make peace again and again. And in May 1941, Rudolf Hess flew alone from Germany to Britain in a single plane and tried to prove with his own physical presence that the Germans really were serious about trying to make peace with Britain. And, of course, he was treated as a lunatic and imprisoned for the rest of his life. Now, the bombing campaign was absolutely monstrous. And it was the British who were primarily responsible, at least in the early stages, but Churchill knew that Roosevelt was on his side. In March of 1941, the United States passed the Lend-Lease Act, in which essentially America agreed to finance the British war effort, even though America was technically still at peace with Germany. Pearl Harbor was still many months away, and yet America was deeply involved with this bombing campaign against civilians. This was mass murder. There was no rational reason for this kind of warfare unless one is some kind of a genocidal maniac. And I'm sorry to say it, but many of America's leaders were genocidal maniacs. Even if the Holocaust story were true, what America actually did during World War II was worse. Not necessarily in terms of the numbers of people who died in various situations, but in terms of the intent of the crime. The United States of America deliberately roasted people to death, women, children, babies, in huge masses, deliberately, with napalm and even atomic weapons by the end of the war. What nation in the entire history of the world has more to be ashamed of than the United States of America? None. Even if the Holocaust stories of gassings were true, what America actually did was far worse. The only reason we might be given a bit of a pass is that the numbers we murdered doesn't come near to 6 million. But the truth is, as far as the German atrocities or alleged atrocities, nothing near 6 million Jews died during the war at all from all causes. And as far as gas chambers, no one died. That part of the story is absolute rubbish. But the propaganda machine that was ramped up already in 1933 here in the United States continued to portray the Germans as just monsters. They were all evil people. They were racially depraved, degenerate, defective somehow, and killing them or wiping them out was perfectly okay. That was the atmosphere that was established even before the first shots were fired. And when the shooting started, America and people like Patton simply carried out their orders, which was to murder Germans, prisoners, women, children, you what have you. So I hope we're entering a saner age, but I don't think so. During the Korean War, the United States murdered about 2 million Korean civilians, women and children as well, in North Korea and in South Korea. During the recent Iraq War, during the interlude between the first Iraq War and the second Iraq War, we killed about 500,000 Iraqi children. And made no apology for that.
Yeah.
If Madeleine Albright actually admitted it on 60 Minutes to Diane Sawyer, and she sort of said, well, she accepted it as being sort of perfectly okay. I can check the exact words she used, but she saw no great crime in that. And what we're seeing in Afghanistan today and Iraq again is not much better. So America should look at itself in the mirror before it tries to preach to the whole world as to what is good and right and so forth. America has an enormous amount to be ashamed of and very little, if anything, to be proud of.
Well, as far as the naval battles, you know, there was such a thing as unrestricted submarine warfare. And in the Nuremberg trials, they tried to convict Karl Dönitz, the head admiral of the German Admiralty, of targeting civilians, but then they had to drop that because they realized that it was the Royal Navy and the United States Navy that had first issued orders to target civilians in submarine warfare. That is, if there were some civilians on the boat, on the ships or whatever, you know, you were supposed to, Germany was helping to save them, to rescue them from the sea and so on. And but the Brits and along with their friends, the Americans, were just targeting everybody. So then Germany was forced to follow suit and do the same. You know, this kind of hypocrisy is just all over the place.
Well, it's not all over the place, but it's especially rampant in American history. Just a few years ago, we had the case of Senator John Kerry, not the one who ran for president, but a senator from Nebraska, who was a Navy SEAL during the Vietnam War. And he commanded a platoon of Navy SEALs on a mission into Cambodia, as I recall, in which they were suddenly confronted by a family of peasants. And for them, suddenly the question was what to do with these peasants. And John Kerry's decision was to kill them, even though they were totally innocent civilians. In order to keep their mission undetected, they decided to kill a family of totally innocent civilians. It was done, and the soldiers involved were furious afterwards. Senator John Kerry denied that it really was like that at all. He claimed that they were being fired upon, and the soldiers in the patrol denied that they were under any fire, but they murdered the civilians. The Navy SEALs really is a criminal organization that, as part of its training, encourages men to kill anybody who might expose them, no matter how innocent they are as civilians. So America has a dirty history. Its military is nothing to be proud of. I'm sorry to be so blunt, but it should be said. The truth cries out. Let me give you an example of something that happened to me, and I'll try to be brief. In 1978, I met a young Hungarian who was maybe 6 or 7 years older than I was on the streets of Queens, New York, and he knew I was a Holocaust revisionist, and I asked him why he didn't join us, and he said, oh no, I'm not interested. I was in Budapest during the bombing of Budapest during World War II. I didn't even know that Budapest had been bombed. And so I was listening and trying to learn something, and he said, oh yes, the Americans bombed Budapest. But, he said, those pilots and crewmen, they were cowardly. They did not bomb the military targets, because the military targets were rather small and heavily defended with anti-aircraft guns, and it was very dangerous for these bombers to fly at low altitude to try to hit these relatively small targets, bridges, railroad crossings, things like that. So what the American bomber crews did was fly around the city and drop their bombs on residential areas, which were vastly bigger and relatively undefended. But some of these bombers were shot down, and the pilots and crew would bail out, and then they would be caught by some of the local farmers and civilians who tried to kill them as soon as they hit the ground. But they were protected by Hungarian gendarmes. And he said that was wrong. And I said, well, they were defenseless enemy crewmen, and the rules of war said they should have been protected and taken to prison camp, etc. He said, no. What should have happened was that these bomber crewmen, and he didn't say just the captains or the officers, he said these bomber crewmen should have been taken to the place where their bombs had fallen and burned alive at the stake. And I was shocked. I was stunned. How could anybody imagine burning other people at the stake like that? And he says, and he looked at me straight in the eyes, said, but that's essentially what they were doing to us. And he looked me straight in the eyes, and I've always remembered his face and his eyes since then. He was right, unfortunately, because some of the high-ranking officers, people like General Curtis LeMay, they should have been put to trial as war criminals after the war, and they should have been burned alive at the stake. That would have been the appropriate punishment for such monsters. These were not heroes, and yet they were praised as heroes after the war, but they were monsters. The United States murdered about 100,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo by carpet bombing the city with napalm. In other words, to deliberately kill civilians. You don't destroy factories and machinery and drill presses with napalm. You burn people alive with napalm. And that's what Curtis LeMay had done in Japan, and for months after that. These were horrendous crimes. And the same was repeated during the Korean War, and I think essentially in the Vietnam War as well. What the hell does this country have to be proud of militarily at all? This is an insane asylum as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sorry to have to be so bold about it, but somebody has to say the truth finally.
Do you think that napalm was used in Hamburg?
I don't know that for a fact, but I know it
was used. What's the difference between napalm and phosphorus bombs and so on, if you can say quickly?
Well, napalm is jelly gasoline, and I think it only came out about 1944. Before that, they used smaller incendiary bombs, which caused essentially the same kind of effect, which was a firestorm. These attacks were deliberately organized to generate firestorms, where the city itself would generate a kind of whirlwind or tornado effect that would pull cool air from the sides of the city towards the center, and then the flames would produce a upward blast of hot air, which would in turn pull in more air. So you would turn the city into a kind of furnace, and the attacks were deliberately organized to achieve that kind of effect. The British general...
This is what I think is so absolutely...
Well, this was monstrous. These people were criminals. Arthur Harris, the general, was a war criminal, and he should have been burned alive at the stake. And any country that has people like that should burn them alive. You know, burning alive was done to blacks as part of legal execution in the United States until the 1820s, for sure, for rape and for certain crimes. And unfortunately, as horrible as it is, there are crimes that are so horrendous that they should be punished in exactly the same way. It's a horrible thing to even think about, but America had committed mass murder by such means as a matter of deliberate policy, and it was widely accepted. During the 1950s, there were two extremely popular television programs narrated by Walter Cronkite on CBS. Every Sunday night for years, you could watch programs in the Air Power series or, I don't know the name of the other program offhand, but these were some of the most popular programs, and they would be on TV every night, every Sunday night for most of the year at 6:30, primetime television for people who had no doubt been in church earlier in the day, who were now eating their supper, and suddenly they were watching cities burning from end to end. And there was no condemnation of this kind of warfare whatsoever, no outrage, no sense of shame whatsoever.
They're told that they were forced to do it in order to stop some kind of awful evil in the world. There's a historian, Donald Bloxham, that has written saying that the bombing of Dresden was a war crime, and that there's a strong case that Winston Churchill was a war criminal. Well, of course, we'd both absolutely agree with that, and that if he had been tried, he would have been found guilty.
Well, depends on how you construct the court. You know, if it had been the Nuremberg court, he would not have been convicted at all. He would have been praised.
But American soldiers, they also raped women, and they raped the Japanese women. It was claimed that they raped women in Okinawa in 1945 during that battle. And there was, I've got a note here that 1,336 were reported rapes, and during the first 10 days of the occupation in one particular prefecture there. And you can imagine that there were a lot more than that, and very little happened from that.
Right, and there were plenty of rapes after the war during the occupation as well. This is a well-known phenomenon for Okinawa. The Okinawan people are outraged that it is somehow condoned and accepted as the price of occupation. But the problem is Americans do not really impose any kind of real discipline on American soldiers. You know, Americans' officers are sort of expected to plead with their men to get them to fight when it's necessary, and that's about it. There's hardly any punishment for American soldiers for any number of infractions that occur during wartime, and this just makes for an impossible situation when you have young teenagers, many of whom are nothing more than juvenile delinquents, and suddenly you give them powerful weapons of mass destruction, you're going to have real trouble unless you have very hard discipline. In the German army, there was very hard discipline. And if a person was guilty of rape or looting or stealing, he was almost certainly going to face capital punishment. that was routine in the German army, and in the German army there was very little rape at any time during the war. Even when you hear stories of the concentration camps, you almost never will ever hear of German SS officers or soldiers raping Jews. It just so ridiculous that even the Jews wouldn't dare to tell such stories. It doesn't happen. And it's because in the German army and the SS, there was a code of honor. Real soldiers don't do that sort of stuff. But the American army was, by and large, a howling mob, especially before the Battle of the Bulge. What happened there was, for one thing, the Malmedy story, which was used by the American military establishment to try, finally, to get some discipline in the American army. They used that story of Americans being massacred at Malmedy, which may have occurred, I don't know for sure, but regardless, it was definitely used to whip up the American soldiers to try to scare them into behaving like soldiers instead of merely a gang of raping, looting, murderers, which is what they were to a great extent in France, not just against Germans, but against French civilians. Mm-hmm. So those are part of the problems that America should face somehow.
Well, I think one thing that we can see is that all these conventions and international laws and Geneva Conventions and the this and the that, international rule of law and so on, it doesn't mean a thing. I mean, they're not having the desired effect, are they? Because it just continues to come down to whoever is the strongest, whoever wins, writes the rules, and they don't face these laws or rules that they themselves have passed.
Well, America certainly got in the way with the violations of international law, you know, and atrocity propaganda is a tool that is used by America's leadership to rationalize all the atrocities it committed. After all, we were fighting evil itself. Therefore, mass murder of German women and children is okay.
And this is why they keep this up today, why they won't let up on it, why there's not going to be any historical revision if they can help it, like there should be as time goes on. They insist on keeping all this anti-German stuff going, and the Holocaust is a big part of that, wouldn't you say? So
They need it for their national survival. If they ever got a case of conscience, they almost certainly have to take ropes and hang themselves, at least all the veterans from the American Army and Navy and Air Force during World War II, especially the American Air Force. If there is no more corrupt and criminal organization than the American Air Force. This is a mass murder incorporated, and American military personnel have really nothing to be proud of. I'm sorry to be so blunt, but that really is what should be said.
Well, this occurs to me that a lot of these vets who now are also going into the schools and on these Holocaust days and so on, which there are so many, and giving their speeches and their talks, they're not Jewish, but they tell big, big lies about what they saw. You know, they all pretend like they were liberating these camps. Most of them were not in the camp liberating divisions and so on, but they say they were. Nobody questions these people, and they tell all these lies about what they saw and what was happening, probably to cover up the horrible stuff that they themselves did.
Yes, I'm looking right now at a picture that is on my website. It's a fairly well-known picture.
We have to.
Okay, it's Eisenhower and Patton and probably Bradley looking at a funeral pyre at Buchenwald with about 30, maybe 40 corpses after they were burned. And it looks horrible. But for these guys to be self-righteous at that point is insane, because these guys were the ones who had committed vastly more horrendous atrocities themselves. Eisenhower was not directly responsible for the bombing of German cities, but his buddies, fellow West Pointers and what have you, they were responsible for committing monstrous scenes and atrocities far, far worse than anything Patton and Eisenhower were looking at in that particular picture or in any of the other pictures.
Okay. Well, that's where we're going to leave it. We've had some strong conversation here, and I hope you all, you listeners, have gotten something out of this. Thank you very much, Fritz, for coming on and sharing with us. And so I'm going to say good night to everyone.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.